Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires that we call the internets is Joe, Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
You know, when you are sitting on the toilet and you suddenly realize there isn't any toilet paper, so you have to get up and do that waddle to get a roll? Yeah. Well, I nearly made it to Walmart.
Oh, now with the pandemic now in over a year, and you had already built up your toilet paper stock before things had started.
Single ply, of course.
Did you have to restock?
We're keeping stocked, but we're not like hoarding.
Okay.
Because being an old Boy Scout, you know, there was a way you could take a single piece of paper and have it last a while. You know, you just fold it into fours and you rip the corner off so that you have a little hole in the middle. And that's how you clean yourself. And you take that little piece that you whip off and wipe your finger off.
That's far more detail than we needed to know.
Okay, then I probably shouldn't mention the poop rag theory, where everybody has their own personal poop rag.
No.
You touch it, you clean it. Okay, yeah, yeah, we won. But no, seriously, I mean, my wife's like, we should just get a bidet.
It's French.
Of course, they'd come up with new ways to squirt water in your derriere.
Yeah.
But that would be most efficient.
I did not go crazy because I'm, you know, I'm here in the compound all by myself, and I have not suffered through any of the shortages at all. Although, when I think back, I still remember the first week when they were starting the lockdowns, the grocery stores ran out of beans. Dried beans.
You want beans.
And as a vegetarian, you know, I use a lot of black beans and garbanzo beans and navy beans.
Oh, yeah.
And it was interesting because I went, it's like, oh, you know, I should probably get some extra black beans and stuff in case I'm not able to make it to the store. That whole area, everything was gone.
Bean town.
Until you went to the Hispanic section of the food mart. There they had all the beans, but for the beans that were next to, like, the soups and everything, oh, those were completely gone, completely picked over. You go to the Hispanic section, didn't even look like it'd been touched.
That sounds about right. All I can think about are those poor employees of the sewer system. But that's not what we're here to talk about.
We're here. Now, I was reading on the interwebs, because that's what I do when I'm stuck at the group home and the clients are all either sleeping or watching baseball. I was reading an article online about how the year 1986 changed comics forever.
Yep.
And we are at the 35th anniversary of that, which I don't even like to think about all that much because it makes me very depressed.
Not as much as, you know, when I look back and think my first comic was in 1977, but go on.
Well, that I can understand because I was in junior high, and for me, junior high was a long time ago. But when I think the 86 or even into the 90s, it's like, well, that was just, you know, like 7, 8, 10 years ago. No. But they talked about a comic that we've talked about. Because it's important, but I thought we could do an entire episode about one of those comics, and that is The Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller, Klaus Janson, and Lynn Varley.
Hacks. All of them hacks.
And I wanted to mention all three, because as we talk about the comic, I'm going to point out some stuff that was pretty unique about it. But you've talked about how you and Pat went big on Dark Knight.
Oh, yeah. I actually talked to Gruber. Because I wasn't sure if my memory of this was right. Now, for a little background, at the time, I think this was one of the times when Batman just was not selling. I often bemoan the fact that a year before Dark Knight hit, I sold my Batman collection, including the first appearance of Tim Fox, bought a quarter a piece, and I was happy to get it. The only other time I can recall, and Corey, correct me if I'm wrong, which you're very good at, right before the Batman TV show, wasn't Batman also in danger of being canceled?
Yes. So, what it was, back in the 60s, Batman sales kind of slumped pretty bad. So the longtime editor was removed and they put Julie Schwartz in charge because Julie had created, you know, he'd been the editor behind the Flash revival and the Green Lantern revival and the Justice League of America. And they said, well, maybe he and Carmine Infantino, who'd taken the Flash and made it a big success, can make Batman a big success. And they did what was called the New Look Batman. And you could tell the change because that's when Batman got the yellow circle around his symbol. Now, before that, Batman, they really were kind of using the Superman formula, where Batman would have goofy adventures based on covers. You know, what is the secret of the Rainbow Batman? Why is Robin dead on a foreign, on an alien planet? Just stuff like that.
No one will recognize Bat-Dog. We will just put a mask on him.
Batman would travel through time. There was a hypnotist who would hypnotize him, and that would cause them to go back in time. I don't know. Yeah. Julie Schwartz came in, and he kind of turned Batman back into kind of a superhero. Then the TV show hit. And they went full on with the TV show. And when the TV show ended, Batman went from selling almost a million copies a month to less than 350,000 copies a month. And if you're thinking, wow, 350,000 copies, this was in the late 60s, early 70s, when 350,000 copies a month for a DC book was not good. So that's when they had Julie Schwartz brought in Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams. Did the revamp on Batman, turned it into, if you look at those covers, it's almost like they're a horror comic. But it was very much the Dark Knight Detective. They moved him out of the Batcave. They got rid of Robin.
Robin so done grew up.
By the time we got to the 80s, now in the mid-70s, they canceled Detective Comics and then decided better of it, and instead merged it with a better-selling Batman book called Batman Family. So there for a while, Detective was kind of one of the dollar comics, and it was Detective Comics featuring the Batman Family.
Yeah.
And then the dollar comics sort of faded away, and they kept Detective as a Batman with a backup story. And Batman would just be a straight Batman comic. But by the time we got to the early 80s, Batman was not selling well. They canceled Detective Comics again over a weekend. Dick Giordano looked at the sales figures and just said, yeah, it's not selling. We're going to have to cancel it. So he gave that order on a Friday. And when he came back on Monday, he felt sick about it the whole weekend. He said, we can't cancel the book that the company is named after, and had the editor revamp it. Got rid of the backup feature, tied it in with Batman so that it was basically story would start at Batman, go to Detective, go back to Batman, back and forth.
I think during this time, Jason Todd was introduced. I remember there was a big... I enjoyed it. I was buying it. I liked the continuity. Bruce Wayne was as strong as Batman. I mean, he was still a character. Batman was a detective. He wasn't like the be-it-all demigod. He kind of became after Dark Knight popped around. And the weird thing is, before we get too much farther, we should mention something that was going on over at Marvel at the time. And, of course, that ties into a little guy named Frank Miller, because he had a real breakaway hit with Daredevil And I know we've talked about this in the past because Daredevil was just a title I don't think anybody cared about because nobody was doing anything. And so he just did his own thing. And holy moly, did it catch on.
Well, it's a little more complicated.
It's always complicated, but we only got an hour to talk about Dark Knight.
Well, I want to give some background on Frank Miller. Frank Miller was trying to break into comics, and they basically gave him Daredevil because it was a bi-monthly book no one gave a shit about. And he and Roger McKenzie were able to do stuff because no one was paying any attention. And then...
The Punisher crossed over. Well, that's what got that's what got a lot of people's attention.
But before
because the last time Punisher showed up, he'd been in Spider-Man. He did a one-shot in Captain America. Did Frank Miller do that?
He did the cover.
Okay, that's why. And then he showed up here. But what got everybody's attention was it was a drug story. And the Comic Code Authority refused to put their cover on it. You know, the little tiny seal on it.
See, you're missing a point. You're missing a point.
Well, I'm missing a lot of points, but I want to get to Dark Knight.
But we'll get there.
Oh, no. That's okay. This will be a two-parter, folks, so be ready.
No. What it was, Miller didn't like the stories that Roger McKenzie was giving him. So he went to the editor and asked if he could take over writing. So they shuffled Roger McKenzie over to another book. And in Frank Miller's first issue, he brought in a new character named Elektra. And that was Daredevil 168. And at that point, Daredevil was selling well enough it went monthly again. Now, Miller, who'd never been on a monthly book before, was having trouble keeping up. So the inker, Claus Janssen, was doing more and more of the actual art. Miller was doing more and more of the layouts. And Miller started building this story toward issue 181. And you're saying that everything exploded with 182 and 183. It was 181. That was the issue where Daredevil was number one in the direct market that month.
And again, I'm saying it because that's when everybody started going bug nuts, looking all the way back to 158, trying to get the first appearances. They didn't care about Elektra yet. But because the Punisher showed up, that got everybody's attention. That got Gruber and mine attention. That's where we ordered heavy on it. So by that time...
Weirdest thing about that Daredevil story.
It was out already.
That was fill-in.
Yeah.
They had done that story for an anti-drug book that they were doing with New York City. And after Daredevil 181, Miller was exhausted because it was a double-size issue. There was a lot of pressure on him because they looked at the orders, and the orders were almost double what they had been 2-3 issues before. They were like, the orders keep going up and up and up and up and up. And 181 was going to be the highest selling comic in the direct market, much like the death of Jean Grey was. So Miller asked if he could have a month off afterward. And they said, well, we've got this other Daredevil story that you mostly completed before New York City said, you know, okay. The change in government, we're not needing that anymore. So they took that story, turned it into a two-parter to give him some breathing room. And if you look after that story, Miller basically just does very sketchy layouts. Claus Janssen is the one who draws most of it. And Miller had taken over writing. On the strength of that, DC poached him away by saying, we want you, and we'll let you do whatever you want. And whatever he wanted was a book called Ronin. It was direct sales only. It was on better paper. It had no ads. And the first issue sold great. And by issue 6, no one cared anymore. To the point where I remember when I started at Shinders in 1988, they still had big stacks of Ronin cover price.
Oh, yeah. And even now, nobody cares. The issues go up in price towards the end, Because like Corey said, number one, number two, number three, you can find for 99 cents almost anywhere. Number four, $2. Number five, $3. Number six, about $11. Because by issue six, nobody cared.
So you had
it came out really weird too. It came out like August, September, then November, then January, then May, then August. So it wasn't timely.
So you had a creator nobody much cared about. Miller kind of went back to Marvel and did Daredevil Born Again, which kind of rejuvenated him. A character nobody cared about in Batman. Even though Batman at the time, you know, Batman sales were in the toilet. Batman was one of DC's lower selling books. But if you looked at the Comic Buyer's Guide annual poll, you know, they did fan awards. Batman would come in as the favorite character, but the book wouldn't sell. They started a team book, Batman and the Outsiders. It sold great, but the regular Batman book didn't sell. So DC was going through all sorts of weirdness. So there's a point in 84 where the powers that be went to Marvel and said, we would like to license our books to you. And Shooter got people to work up pitches. He had John Byrne work up a pitch to take over Superman. He had George Perez work up a pitch to take over Wonder Woman. And he had Frank Miller work up a pitch to take over Batman. And eventually the legal department said, we can't do this. We're already being sued for being a monopoly by this little company in Illinois called First Comics, which was literally created for that lawsuit. So they canceled it. Byrne, who gets pissed off when you drop a pencil, was pissed off at Marvel, went over to DC, said, you know that Superman pitch? Let's do it. And DC was like, yeah, we're rebooting our whole line. Julie Schwartz is going to be retiring. We're going to give you Superman. George Perez, they worked out a deal because at the time, from the creation of Wonder Woman until halfway through Crisis on Infinite Earths, the contract with the creator's family was they had to have a Wonder Woman comic every month or the rights would revert back. They flat out bought Wonder Woman from the family so that they didn't have to deal with that, canceled the Wonder Woman comic, and had George Perez start on his pitch. With Batman, the editor was Denny O'Neill. He didn't want to cancel and start over. So what they did, Miller's pitch became two books, one of which was Batman Year One. Themes and ideas from the pitch that weren't in Year One were put into this book called Batman The Dark Knight Returns, and it would be 20 years after Batman had retired. It was $2.95 when regular comics were 75 cents. It was on the best paper available. It would be square bound with a hard cardstock cover. And all I can think is, you know, for me, I was still a Miller fan and I enjoyed Ronin. But when I talked at my local comic shop, he was, oh, it's too expensive and nobody cares about Batman. And Frank Miller, last time he did this, it bombed. I'm not going to order a whole lot. And he wasn't the only one, because the initial orders for Dark Knight Returns, according to Paul Levitz, were 75,000 copies. Now, my question to you, Joe, why did you go big on it with all of those factors?
Because we liked Frank Miller and we thought, oh my God, he's doing Batman. And again, for us, it would be like, I think Pat said he might have ordered 10 for himself. I think we went in tens. We each ordered 10. 10 for me, 10 for him, and then 10 for, we used to buy, again, we were called P&J Comics. That was what we bought and we sold together at cons. So for us, that was pretty heavy. Not as heavy as Pat ordered John Byrne's Man of Steel. I mean, that I think he finally years ago got rid of the last. I mean, I think he went into the hundreds with that. But we had a good feeling on it just because we were excited. We like Frank Miller and we thought maybe he'd be doing Batman really well. And again, by that time, I had already quarter boxed all my Batman collection. So we were looking forward to it. We had no idea it would be as crazy as it would. And I was just going to pop over to Atomic Avenue for a second, because when it was, and again, this is years before everything. Is it Batman Dark Knight or just Dark Knight Returns?
The Dark Knight Returns. Now, the other thing Paul Levitt said was, they had so much faith in this book, even though the initial orders were just 75,000, they upped the print run to 125,000. Because this was a new format that had never been done before, he, a couple of people from production, and Miller themselves went to Sparta, Illinois, where it was printed, to oversee the printing and make sure that it came out the way they wanted. Now, the format was so different that I remember up until like 89 or 90, it was any comic that was printed in that square-bound cardstock cover, Baxter paper, was called the Dark Knight format until Marvel finally found a name and called it Prestige format. Because Marvel's not going to put in their solicitation, Havoc Wolverine Meltdown. Dark Knight format. But for years, comic shops called it that, and the solicitation, even for non-DC books, called it the Dark Knight format. When it came out, the first thing about it was that within days it was gone. And it had to be that people came into the shops, saw that cover, flipped through the book. It looked like nothing, no other comic on the stands at the time. Didn't look anything like it.
What's weird is Miller did 16 panels a page. It was incredible. And I'm looking for it now. DC actually made 3 printings of it. The problem is you got to look inside to see the printing. Atomic Avenue has the first prints as high as $83, $92. Second prints as high as $78. They don't have any third prints up there. So I'm on the eBays trying to confirm that crazy price, other than CGC, of course.
And the other thing about it, and as I reread it recently, while they form a single story, you can read each issue on its own, and it gives you a beginning, middle, and end. The first issue, we don't know what has happened. We just know Batman is retired and Bruce Wayne is doing stuff to give himself some sort of thrill. There's tons of comedy in it.
And there's a lot of interesting reading too, because they have one where he breaks into the newscasts that tell things that are going on. Like, it's just super hot in Gotham, and there's a storm coming. Why would you care? You will as the story goes on. Sometimes it's somebody who's inspired by Batman, dresses up like a bat, and decides to stop a crime, and then there's a news story. Such and such was died after he tried to stop a foil robbery, dressed up as the Batman. The weird thing was, and as you read through it, there was not a lot of other superheroes about. It had been like, what'd you say, Corey, 20 years since anybody had seen Batman?
Yes. 20 years since he'd retired. There were hints that the superheroes had been banned. And the other thing was that he used media to tell the story. So much of the story was told through news being shown on a page.
I'm just on the eBays and I'm going, my mind is blown. I mean, complete Frank Miller Dark Knight Returns sets with a third print on it for $180. The number one first print for $200.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this book has gone iconic. It's you can find a decent slabbed one up into the thousands of dollars.
Now, the other thing that DC did that they hadn't done before, I worked at the college newspaper. I did movie reviews and I had a weekly column. DC bought ads in college newspapers all around the U.S. for Dark Knight and Ambush Bug. And they gave us those issues of Dark Knight and Ambush Bug to review. Rolling Stone did a story on Dark Knight Returns number one. And before you think, well, yeah, and magazines and stuff do stories on that all the time. Not back then they didn't. Back then the only stories you ever saw about comics were Biff, Zhao, Ping, comics are worth money. Your old comics can be worth hundreds of dollars. They never talked about the stories. They never talked about the creators. They never talked about any of that. And the term comic book was an insult. Reviews at the time, I remember Commando came out and they said, this is a stupid comic book type movie. In TV and movies, if you wanted to show somebody was an idiot, you would have them reading a comic book. At the group home this weekend, the clients likes older sitcoms. They show Gomer Pyle. Gomer Pyle, Shazam! And they'd show him reading comics. Why? Because he's a moron. Old movies, whenever they'd show somebody reading a comic, he's a moron. It was shorthand for this person's subliterate. This person's an idiot. They're a child. This was a comic that kind of exploded, and the mainstream press took interest in it, partly because of the format, partly because DC did a hell of a job with marketing, and partly because when you open it up, it didn't look like any other comic. It was paneled different. You talked about how there were 16 panels to a page, except when Miller wanted something big, so that when he did have that full page of Batman leaping off the roof, the rain falling on his chest, and he would say, it feels like a baptism. It would have that impact, that explosion of going from small, claustrophobic, closed in to big, expressive stuff that just blew off the page. Lynn Varley did. They didn't have computer coloring back then. Lynn Varley had to create a new kind of coloring to give the shades that she wanted because they had better printing, better paper. They didn't have to worry about it getting all muddy. Grab an issue of Crisis on Infinite Earths printed around the same time. You'll see that the colors don't even quite match up with the lines in some places because they were using this flexographic press, which was a plastic printing press because it was cheaper than the metal printing press. They took so much care in how this thing was presented and looked that not only did comic fans see this huge leap forward, but people outside comics were like, this is well printed. This is really well done, to the point where as it was going, Warner Books, who had never printed a comic before, agreed to reprint when the whole thing was done in a trade paperback that they would sell in bookstores. Now, yes, there had been the Fireside books, you know, Origins of Marvel Comics and Son of Origins and books like that. But just a book that would reprint a single comic book story, never been done before. So, Joe, when you got your Dark Knights at that first convention, did you have any left at the end of the day?
I would probably have to say no. Because I know we did end up buying, you know, second and third prints when they were offered, which were was amazing because they didn't really reprint a lot of comics in those days.
Yeah, if a book sold out, it sold out. I remember when the Simonson Thor 337 came out, and it was one that sold out the first day because it was Thor. Nobody cared about Thor, and people got so hyped about Walt Simonson coming on that, boom, it was gone everywhere. This was more, okay, it sold out because it's a different format. We can reprint this once they got enough orders. And there are more second prints than first prints. There are more third prints than second and first prints. Because as these articles came out about the book, as the ads hit about the book, there was more demand every week. And the story itself, it's science fiction, it's comedy, it's superhero, and it's very much influenced by how much Frank Miller loved Raymond Chandler, Mickey Spillane, Dashiell Hammett. When you read The Dark Knight, you can see this is his pastiche of those old first-person narrative detective stories. With so many iconic lines, Bruce Wayne is crashing his race car. This would be a good death, but not today.
Some of the humor would be there's a little kid watching as Batman's fighting the villain and kick his ass, Batman. Batman, as he's reeling from a gut shot, don't swear, kid.
Or Carrie's parents, who are just burned out hippies, don't have any clue what's going on.
Say, didn't we have a daughter? Oh, and that was the thing, too, when people were asking Frank Miller about what is Robin going to be in the book. He goes, oh, yeah, she'll be in there. She's white. Now, it was kind of interesting because later on, and one of these days I'll talk, I know I've talked about it in the past, but I was working at college radio and we got a huge box of graphic novels. Man of Steel, Shadow by Chaykin, Dark Knight, Watchmen. There was another one. What I had done is I had the production department make ads for these things. And then every hour or whenever they would run an ad and then you could win this graphic novel. So I made the script for the Dark Knight. And I pretty much used the copy ad that DC gave me. And Robin's in there. She's white. Well, apparently that was too much for the production department. You know, back then it was called political correctness. I said, oh, we can't do that. So they changed it to Robin's there. She's changed a bit. And I had to stop and explain. They didn't change it back. I had to explain. I said, no, you're missing the point. First of all, it's a quote from the creator. Second of all, it's not that she's white. It's that it's a girl. Because for however many years Batman, Robin's been around, it's always been a guy. And now it's suddenly a girl. That's what's shocking. Not that she's white. But what are you going to do? It was college, you know. Didn't want to offend anybody.
And it was also playing off the joke that's been going around forever. You know, a racist guy dies, goes up to heaven, meets God. She's black. She's not happy with him. He was playing off that joke. Which it was back when Miller had more of a sense of humor. And then the delays started instantly. The second issue was delayed. I don't even know how long. I just know that the second issue was late, third issue was later, and the fourth issue was so late we didn't ever think it would come out. And here's the thing. The second issue came out, stores had had enough time to realize this thing was a hit. They bumped their orders up even more. Joe, you're probably on Atomic Avenue. How many printings did issue two go through?
Oh, sorry, it disappeared. See what happens when you ask for it? I think it went through only two.
Yeah. But it had to have a second printing as well. And by this point, the first issue was shooting up in price. You know, it was $2.95, but it was going for $10, $15, $20. Because as soon as retailers would get it in, it would sell out. When the third issue came out.
Oh, I'm wrong. They did three printings on that one as well.
Okay.
Two of the second. But by the time the fourth came out, they knew. So yeah. They didn't do any extra printings then.
Now, when the third issue came out, DC announced, basically, we're not going to be reprinting issue one anymore, but don't worry, we're going to be doing a collected trade paperback, which was unheard of. We're going to be doing a collected trade paperback after the fourth issue comes out.
Not to be confused with the Graffiti Design signed and numbered hardcover.
Which was the first one to be announced.
Yeah.
And it was a limited edition. And shops collectively lost their shit.
Yep.
The Comic Buyer's Guide was filled with letters from retailers. Why are you doing it where it's limited and only could get so many copies? And I could easily sell, you know, this many. And I've been told that no matter how many I order, there's only going to be 5,000 printed. And was it 5,000 or 1,000? One of the two.
Let me go look that up here. It wasn't a lot. I was just looking at them on eBay. I mean, they're crunching around 1,000. Well, no, yeah. You can still find them for about $350. So, I mean, they're not crazy. But let me see if I can find. I can't get there. Somebody got a scan of the page because they. Oh, here we go. It was also signed by Frank Miller.
Yeah.
And they only made 4,000 of them.
Okay. And shops lost their minds that DC kept putting out press releases and calling shops to say, this is the limited hardcover. There will be a regular trade paperback. You know, this is the limited collector's one. There will be one that we're putting out and one that Warner is putting out. And they put out both covers, letting retailers know, hey, don't get mad at us. We're going to have these trade paperbacks out for you. And by the time the fourth issue came out, shops did what they always did. They ordered way too many. And I believe it came out almost a year after the first issue. And when I worked at Shinders, again, this came out probably 86, early 87, when I started working there in 88. Along with Ronin number 6, they had big old stacks of Dark Knight number 4. And if I had any brains at all, I would have bought them all. But I was like, ugh, everybody's buried in these. You know, it's over. Yeah. It's over, Johnny. It's over.
Now, I do
they
recall.
They had a stack that filled the shelf. It had to be 20 to 25 copies. And when we would sell through them, boom, there's another stack.
Yeah. I do recall when the books were ordered because Pat ordered like 4 or 5 of them, and I thought he was nuts. I said, there's no way we're going to sell these things. And I was wrong because they were hot. I do remember helping Al Payne the day they came out because people were lined up at Dreamhaven. Now, this was their little corner shop on the same side as the theater was in Dinkytown. So they have a lot of room to begin with. I was just waiting, and Al motioned for me to come in, and I came in, and they had these things all over the floor as they were trying to get not only the regular comic order, but all the books ready because they knew all these guys outside were waiting for the books. And because they were so hot, I ended up ordering – I got one of each from them anyways. As a side note, that particular book has also a rare distinguishing feature in the history of P&J Comics, as when we brought them to a con, it was the first thing we ever had jacked from us. I was like, Pat, did you sell one? I didn't sell it. So if you're the motherfucker out there that's got it, I will find you. I will hunt you down. And I will cut your thumbs out. And then I'll take that book back and sell it for like $100 on eBay.
Now, I didn't buy the trade paperback. I waited because they talked about doing a complete Frank Miller Batman. That was a $30 leather-bound book. That
would have yes.
That, it would have year one, which started right as Dark Knight ended.
And Wanted, Santa Claus Dead or Alive, which was a DC special. Was that 86 that thing came out?
Oh, no, it was 79.
Oh, wow, that was a long...
Early yeah, yeah. In,
and believe in, me, that book early in Miller's that story. Book went up crazily in price, too, because people were like, oh, my God, that could be but, Batman, Frank Miller, no less, hot, gotta get... I laugh because I've got my complete copy, my complete Frank Miller Batman that I got for $5, because this thing's been beat to hell. It's got water damage, but it reads fine. Matter of fact, this is my go-to if I want to read The Dark Knight Returns, which is what I did before this podcast hit.
And it's funny how each issue stood on its own. The first was the return of Batman. The second was him taking over the gangs. The third was Joker. And the fourth was Batman versus Superman, which was the... It was such a big thing. DC was still printing World's Finest Comics. And with Miller doing this story where Batman and Superman were on opposite sides, it leaked into all the other DC books to where the last few issues of World's Finest, Batman and Superman didn't much like each other.
Yeah, I remember that last issue of World's Finest where Batman saved Superman and then chewed him out, telling him the world needs Superman. You can't be doing stupid things like that. Blah, 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 blah. So from there on out, Batman and Superman didn't like each other.
They respected each other, but they didn't like each other. And they didn't team up very often. And when they did, Batman was always looking for an edge over Superman, which is how Batman was the... Batman became the only person who had kryptonite in the post-crisis universe. In case Superman lost control, Batman would be the one to take him down. And I think that's where we eventually got the Batman has a plan to take down all the heroes. It all came from that Dark Knight story. Another thing in the Dark Knight story was that in that first issue, we saw that Jason Todd had died.
Yep.
So it kind of put the sword of Damocles over Jason Todd's head. Where, when is he going to die? 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 And so when you got to Death in the Family, and it was a vote to kill Robin, people voted because that means it'll be more like Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Either way, Robin, that Jason Todd would have been put out of commission for quite a long time because Denny O'Neill didn't like Robin.
Jim Starlin,
who was writing it at the time, didn't like Robin. So Jim Starlin made the new Robin a complete asshole.
So now I have a question for you, though. This is something I've never figured out. So I talked about how I enjoyed the Batman before Dark Knight, even though nobody else did. So what the story was, it was Jason Todd was very much like Robin, Dick Grayson.
Way too much like him to the point where his parents were circus performers who died in an accident.
Now, what was interesting, though, is because they did this whole storyline, and I can't remember the name of the villain, where she tried to outmaneuver and adopt Jason.
Nocturna.
And Batman was powerless, and it took Bruce Wayne to try to prevent that. And you can still see signs of it because if you go to Teen Titans 50, I believe that's the wedding issue of Donna Troy, there's a scene on a balcony where the women are gawking because both Dick Grayson and Bruce Wayne are standing there talking about this situation where Dick's apparently like, why? How's the situation going? He's going, it's not good, blah, blah, blah. And Dick asks Batman, or Bruce, why you never adopted me? And he says, you know, I was too young and I was too early into my career. It didn't occur to me, but rest assured you are as much a son to me as anybody. So there are still signs of that elsewhere in the DC universe. I thought that was a brilliant deduction, a different way of doing it. And then when Batman finally did win the rights, he went to train Jason as the new Robin. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, Jason was a thug jacking Batman's tires. And I was like, what in hell's bells just happened?
Crisis.
But it wasn't even billed as a crisis thing because it was like next month.
After Crisis, they kind of, Denny O'Neill said, well, we're not going to start over with the new number one, but we'll have this year one, and I want to change how Batman stories are told.
And he did it, but he didn't, I don't recall anything anywhere explaining, yeah, we're rebooting this as well.
No, they didn't.
But Denny, that was an asshole thing to do.
Denny went to Max Collins and said, you need to change Robin's origins. We've got this cool idea where Batman catches him stealing the wheels off the Batmobile. And Max Collins has, you know, he's given tons of interviews where he and Denny O'Neill just did not agree on what they should do. And while he agreed that Jason Todd should have a different origin than Dick Grayson, the big problem with Jason Todd was his origin was exactly the same as Dick Grayson. He didn't like the fact that Robin was kind of being made into a jerk. I also want to point out, Joe, do you know how you could tell that New Teen Titans was a much more sold better and more powerful book than Batman at the time before Dark Knight? Marv Wolfman's the one who said, I'm taking Robin and we're going to turn him into Nightwing. And the Batman people had to go along with it. Yeah. They had no say in it at all because New Teen Titans was selling through the roof and Batman was not. So when he, and one of the stories that he started when he started New Teen Titans was Robin is no longer a sidekick. He's a team leader. And he wanted to bring that story full circle by giving him a new identity. And when it came time, he just went to the Batman office and said, here's what I'm doing. Take it or leave it. And they had to take it.
Now, the question I have as well, because a lot of people point at Dark Knight and they say, this is about the time when Batman started turning dark.
Yes.
And everybody else thought, oh, well, that's true, so I'll make my characters dark as well. Is that a generalization, or do you think that's fairly accurate?
I think it's fairly accurate. You had that. You had Alan Moore's Miracle Man, which kind of took Captain Marvel and made it dark. You had Watchmen. And you had the other thing, there was kind of this zeitgeist in the air where everybody wanted to do superheroes in the real world. Watchmen was kind of billed as, what if superheroes were in the real world? Dark Knight was kind of a more realistic version of superheroes. Miracle Man, again, realistic version of superheroes, to the point where when Marvel's 25th anniversary, which was the same year, Jim Shooter's pitch to people was superheroes in the real world. That's what we're going to do. And if you read all of the hype that he wrote, he talked about how, you know, when Stan Lee and Jack Kirby did the Fantastic Four, they made the superheroes more real. We're now going to take that next step where when a superhero picks up a building, you'll see all the plumbing and everything underneath.
And it was supposed to be in real time, too. A month was a month.
Yeah. And it showed me that Shooter knew about the idea, but he was too stuck in that comics are for kids way of thinking, to where everybody else is like, what are the political, social ramifications of beings like this? And he was more, well, we need to make the buildings more realistic, rather than, what would happen if somebody had superpowers? And so Marvel kind of missed the boat on it. And the problem was, out of that, people took the wrong lessons. You also had Howard Chaykin come in and do The Shadow. And if you read The Shadow, the violence is utterly over the top because, one, Chaykin didn't much like The Shadow. And two, he went back and read the pulps, and the pulps are unbelievably violent and bloody. So he took The Shadow back. Not the Shadow that you think of with the, you know, the nice radio drama, but no, the Shadow from the pulps who, you know, would empty clips into guys and would toss them off buildings, and the writer would describe how their limbs splayed when they hit the ground. And then you had Mike Grell do Longbow Hunters, which was, let's get away from the stupid trick arrows. Arrows go through people and it hurts. And Grell had already kind of went into that ground with his series John Sable Freelance, which showed the consequences of violence. And his Green Arrow was the same thing. We're going to show the consequences of violence. We're going to show, we're moving him to a grittier area. We're going to have him be middle-aged, and we're going to show the consequences of the violence. The problem was that so many people learned the wrong lesson, and it was, well, we need to be darker and violent, rather than we need to make these stories more mature and have the violence have consequences. Miller also at the same time would do whacked out weird stuff like Elektra Assassin. You read that now. He and Sienkiewicz, just complete over-the-top weirdness, psychedelia. With Dark Knight, he was drawing from those old detective stories. He then went on and did Sin City, which may as well have been 50s crime stories. May have well been written by Mickey Spillane. Sorry. But other lesser creators, they took that. They took the stuff that Alan Moore did, and they did the everything you know is wrong. Because Alan Moore liked doing kind of a reinvention of a hero when he would take it over. He did it with Miracle Man. He did it with Captain Britain. He did it with Swamp Thing. So you got stupid stories like Firestorm is actually a fire elemental, and Red Tornado is a wind elemental. No, Red Tornado was a robot.
From Earth 2.
No, Earth 2, it was an old woman in red underwear and a pot on her head. The Red Tornado at DC Earth 1 was the robot that we haven't heard of in forever. Because he's kind of boring. He's a robot who spins, okay?
Yeah. Although Peter David got a hold of him years later. He made him interesting.
You had some good stuff come out of it, like Animal Man, Sandman. It wasn't all just dark and gritty. You also brought in a more literary form of comics. In a lot of ways, comics grew up with us. When we read them in the 70s, they were aimed at, you know, teenagers. In the 80s, they started aiming them more at adults. And by the time you got to the early 90s, you had Vertigo, you had Epic, you had, you know, the indies that were all catering to an older reader, not in, oh, we could show boobies and have swears. But but you give Sandman to a 12-year-old, they're just going to scratch their head and not know what the hell's going on. And I'm not going to say that Dark Knight caused all of it, but Dark Knight changed how comics were perceived outside of comic shops. It created a new format. It created the idea that a miniseries, when it was done, would be collected in a trade. So before that, you did not have waiting for the trade. It didn't exist. At Marvel, they didn't even really get into trades until after Bob Harris was fired for not having trades available for the X-Men movie, whereas DC had tons of trades and were making half their income from trades of Preacher and Sandman and Dark Knight and Watchmen. And so in a lot of ways, Dark Knight changed the comic industry as well as comic storytelling. And the beautiful thing about it is you could go back at Dark Knight, because it was kind of set in the future, still relevant.
Although some of the references may be dated, especially if you don't understand who Ronald Reagan was. Yeah.
But, you know, the way he showed cable TV has not changed at all. It's still put two people on and let them argue. It's just one of them is going to be Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah. Or Lana Lang.
Now, believe it or not, we have gone on for an hour about Dark Knight. Joe thought that this would take for, you know, two episodes. It's not. Matter of fact, we still have time to talk about these guys, our sponsors. Believe it or not, kids, this here podcast has sponsors. And that sponsor, since day one, is DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best, bar none, web host in the whole known universe. And if you need a website, head on over to DreamHost.com, put in code CRAZY, that's K-R-A-Y-Z, and get $20 off your first year. Now, if you would like to advertise here on any of the Solitaire Rose Network podcasts, you can just email me at SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com, subject advertising. Also, head on over to eBay and look for user Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z, that's Joe Crazy Writer, who's always telling us about the eBay in every episode of Crazy Comics and Stories. If you would like to contact us, you can do so. You can give us a call at 952-856-0519. Leave a message and we'll play it on the show. Or you can send us an email at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. Thanks. And here's all the other podcasts I do, as well as stuff I do for PW Insider. The Solitaire Rose Radio Network is currently on a pause, basically because COVID-19 has made it so that I have to work a lot of extra hours at both jobs, but you can still go and listen to my other podcasts. Now, you're probably listening to Crazy Comics and Stories, which is the main podcast, but on this same feed, K-R-A-Y-Z-C-O-M-I-X, is Solitaire Rose Radio, the solo radio podcast that I do. I've done interviews, I've done short stories, I've done all sorts of things, and you can get to it right here on this same feed. I also do a podcast called Novelcast, where I take the novels I've written and turn them into free audiobooks. That's over at novels.solitairerose.com. Dangerous Dan Moore and I, and of course Wolfie B. Bad, give you bad advice over at badadvice.solitairerose.com. You send in your questions, and we give you the aforementioned bad advice. And then myself and Adam Vermillion from For the Love of Comics do the Fantastic Forecast at fantasticforecast.solitairerose.com, where we go through the issues of the Fantastic Four, four issues at a time, to give the plot and commentary on each issue. That's not all. Yes, I'm crazy. I still, over at pwinsiderelite.com, every week on Wednesday, do a recap of the latest episode of AEW Dynamite. I write up what happened, and then myself and Anthony Pyrus will do an audio. Now, you can only listen to the audio if you're a member at pwinsiderelite.com, and if you're a wrestling fan, you should be, where we then break down the episode, talk about what we liked, what we didn't like, give it a grade, and let you know if you should have watched that episode. Those are the other podcasts here at the Solitaire Rose Radio Network. Thanks. And now we get to Joe's favorite part of the show.
Oh, where I get to eat some Cheetos and get orange all over my fingers.
No, no, no. It's where you talk about what's going on the eBays.
Oh, that's right. I do sell on eBay.
Are you selling shiny rocks?
I got all sorts of stuff. Matter of fact, even as we talk, I just sold, let's see, where'd it go? Twist number 3. Corey, tell the folks about Twist.
Twist.
It's from Kitchen Sink.
Was that an anthology book?
I think it might have been just a comic, because it came up number 3, 1988. Kurtzman and Crumb and all sorts of people were in it.
Okay, yeah, it was an anthology. Just kind of a collection of short stories from...
Yep.
From people. I don't even remember if there was a theme to it or not.
Probably not. But I had a copy, and it sold. But that I didn't even get a chance to talk about it. I just wanted to mention it because even as we were talking, it popped up. Because what's cool about it, you know, the eBay is always on 24/7. Some other things I sold, a book called Journey from Aspen. We might have mentioned this before. This was all part of the whole Turner line. This particular one, let's see, Trekking Through Violence, Dangerous Frontier of Savage Barbarians, Devious Thieves, and Wild Creatures. A warrior princess named Ara searches for her mother, who was stolen away from her kingdom by a mysterious sorcerer with the help of his powerful... Dijin? Am I saying that right?
Jin.
And I can't, what a great, terrible secret to await her in the distant horizon. This is Ara's journey. J-I-R-N-I. And again, a couple different volumes. What's interesting about it is that there's always like an Aspen Store variant cover, or if you can find the variant cover C, that's kind of the limited edition one. Always decent art, things like that. Another book I sold, this is one of those that I tried and just didn't get it. Titan Comics 2017 came out with Robotech. I had an issue number one, just the variant cover with, I don't know who it is, some lady in a blue dress or green dress who obviously had nothing to do about being in a Robotech. So maybe she was one of the interests or whatever. I don't know. Might be some Secret Wars hotness going on because all of a sudden I sold two of the miniseries I have left. Guardians of Nowhere and the three-issue Star-Lord and Kitty Pride. I think I picked a lot of these up when I either picked them up after the fact when stores were trying to blow them out, or I just picked them up because I thought, well, you got three issues. I have a boring weekend. Let's buy them that way. Because a lot of times stores will put together crossovers and just leave them there on a rack rather than hook them into the back issues. So then on a slow week, I'll come in and go, oh, you got all four issues of Guardians of Nowhere. I know it ties into Secret Wars somehow. Of course, I'm waiting for the super duper compendium or omnibus that has it all. I'm waiting. I mean, really, my orders at Marvel have dropped. I know you're reprinting a bunch, but you got new stuff to get to. Come on, let's get to it. I got money to spend. I don't have any. Well, I do have a few copies. Hey, Corey, have you ever heard of DC's comic Date with Debbie?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
It was one of their Archie knockoffs.
Yeah. It went 18 issues. From 69 to 72, and it really, you look at it and you'd swear it was an Archie book. Same type of covers. There's the Debbie, the hot redhead, cuddling up to her boyfriend. Music, soft lights. What more can you ask for, buddy? And buddy, potato chips. We're all out of them. Ha, ha, ha. So, let's see. I sold a couple variant covers. 2006, one of the Aquaman series. Aquaman. This was Kurt Busiek's run. You remember the one-year later shtick that they did?
Yes.
This was Aquaman, sort of Atlantis. Nobody knew what was going on. Looks like he has his hand back. I don't know. I barely remember it. Did you ever see the Disney movie Fox and the Hound?
Yes.
Whitman did a three-issue series in 1981 on it. What's interesting is the covers are not drawn, but actual, I guess, stills from the actual movie. And I'm looking in. It looks like, I think it was just a straight comic book adaptation. I had one, not that great a shape, but these are surprisingly rare because, you know, we weren't buying. Corey, would you have bought this as a young kid on a newsstand?
I don't believe they were on newsstands. I believe at that point, Whitman was only sold in those comic bags.
Oh, the three packs. That could be.
Yeah.
Because they're very expensive if you can find them in nice shape.
Because I wanted to get... I'd heard that Kirby had done an adaptation of The Black Hole.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that one.
I could never find it, and it's because it was only sold in those three packs, and the three packs were only in certain toy stores. And we didn't go to toy stores. We didn't have any toy stores. We had a toy section at Farm King, and you got to hang out there if you were lucky.
You want to know how much issue number 4 is?
I'm scared.
$900 near mint price guide.
Jeez.
So the movie adaptation was 1 and 2. I think 3 might have been part of it. I don't know what the deal is with number 4. It must have come out and was just put in the 3-packs because that's the key to find. In other words, even if you find a beat up one somewhere, if you know a near mint's going for $1,000, and I haven't looked on the eBays, but let me, while we're talking here, let's see. Black Hole.
Let you whip this number out.
4 in collectibles. Let's see if we can find any. Because, of course, what I usually find is by the time you figure out what the near print mint price is, yep, it was distributed in multi-packs only, not necessarily with the Black Hole. Let's see, an 8.5 is listed CGC at $1,600. Going down, I don't see any unslabbed. The cheapest one, if you're so inclined to go get one, would be a 5.0 for almost $457. So just crazy stuff. It's kind of a step back talking to the last book. I don't know if we've ever mentioned Ghost Manor. This was from Carlton Group. 2 series. The one I got was from the second series, which they published 71 to 84. Mr. Bones is your host, not the DC guy. It might be the same. You never know with continuity. Just kind of anthology. Again, horror, horror. Some are, meh. I mean, I've read a few of them. I didn't think much about them. If you can find them near mint, they are very pricey because these comics only seem to have survived beat to hell. Again, I have no idea if anybody was collecting them.
I would buy them if they had Ditko art.
And I don't even see Ditko listed. So if he did,
worked for them until they.
That would be the first series.
Shut down in 76, 77, started up again later that year. And at that point is when Ditko went back to Marvel.
Yeah. He might have been more prevalent in the first series because there are 2 distinct series. The one I had was the second batch. I did mention that because about the Black Hole, because you never know what's going to be valuable. Corey, what is the last issue of The Flaming Carrot?
Oh, geez. I honestly don't know. For some reason, 17 is stuck in my head.
How about what is the who did Flaming Carrot face off with? In that last issue. I'll give you a hint. World's toughest mailman. Milkman.
Oh, Reed Fleming.
Do you want to guess what the near mint price for one of them bad boys is? It's issue number 32, by the way, from 2002.
Wow. 17 must have been when they left Renegade Press. That might be my head.
Yeah, because 18 was Dark Horse.
Yeah.
And then the last issue was... 32, and 31 was interesting because Herbie from Dark Horse.
Nothing.
Yep. That has a near mint price of $45. But can you know the face-off between Flaming Carrot and Reed Fleming, World's Toughest Milkman? Guess how much?
I'm going to go $50.
Nope. 87.
Wow.
And I've seen them for $100. There's people who have lesser conditions for 30. This came to my attention because my daughter Dana, as she prepares for grad school, moving cross country.
Oh, where to?
I don't know if she wants me to say yet, so I'll kind of keep it under hat. But I know we'll probably have an episode out of it because we're going to go visit it. And of course, when I visit a place, I got to figure out where the comic stores are. So we got that to look forward to. But she dumped a bunch of graphic novels and stuff that she just wasn't keeping. I'm real curious to see what she kept. She basically brought back every graphic novel I own that Grant Morrison ever did, including my Invisibles collection. So I got that back. tons of other things. And as I went through and priced them, I mean, there are things that are out of print, licensed books that are just wild prices. And I'm not talking what people are asking, but then I go to the other side of eBay, because you can do a search under advance, click the sold button and see, well, yeah, they say Flaming Carrots, $100 book, but is it really? And then you find out, oh my gosh, somebody did buy it for that. So I'll be putting a lot of that stuff up on the eBay. So if you suddenly see a bunch, again, you go to my main page, Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z, you flip on that search. You can search just like you do on the eBay. And in this case, what you do is you look for newly listed. You'll see by that time all the graphic novels, or at least the more expensive ones that she got, I'll have them up and ready to rock. I'll even probably have that Flaming Carrot up for somebody. And if you're interested, as you know, as fans of this here show, you can always send me a quick note and say, hey, I enjoy the show. I saw you got this up for an outrageous price. And I know the money is going to go right to Dana and her grad student fund. But would you take this for it? And I'll probably go, you betcha. You've been warned, baby. K-R-A-Y-Z. Come get some.
And now we get to my favorite part of the show.
Oh, lighthouse pictures. Oh, I love lighthouses.
No, no, no. Not where I sit back and sip bourbon.
Oh, that was my bourbon.
Oh. No, it's Freakin' and Geekin' Joe. What are you freaking on?
Well, that I can't find my freaking list. Where the hell did it? Oh, here it is. All right, let's see. Ladies and gentlemen, COVID has returned to the Ryder household. May I swear?
Yeah.
Fuck.
Even though you said last week you wouldn't.
I know, but this was a fuck, because it's just kind of weird. I'm not going to talk too much about it, because my COVID test is out, so hopefully by next week I'll know whether or not I have it or not. I have had the shot. The Johnson & Johnson shot, it's not as potent as the Pfizer 2 shot. But what they said is that, you know, you might still get it. You just probably won't end up in the hospital, because it's not going to collapse your respiratory system. So it brings in a number of questions, especially like I am supposed to get my next crown next month. And if you remember the story of my first crown last November, I hung on to that crown about 3 weeks longer than I should have, because although it wasn't COVID, I caught pneumonia. So sing it with me, folks. What a drag it is getting old. So just, it's not over. I think you got your shots, didn't you, Corey?
I have not.
Really? I would have thought with you being in the, working with the group home, that you'd have been like first on the list.
Well, they gave shots to everybody at the group home during business hours.
I just slouched.
So, and I said, you know, is there any place where I could get it where, you know, I'm not working? And nope, it's got to be at this time. And the thing that really annoyed me was the shots were given by our nurses. They could have stayed till 6. They could have done it 4 to 6. But no, they wanted to be done by 5. So I did sign up with the Minnesota State site. And I got an appointment, and it was for a Saturday morning, and I had it where it's okay. I leave the group home, I drive downtown, I wait for an hour, I get my shot, I'm done. And then the staff who was supposed to relieve me showed up 2.5 hours late.
Ugh.
So I'm now still trying to reschedule.
I swear, dude, the whole fucking world's against us.
And when I got an email from the nurse saying, you know, you really need to get this shot for blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, here's what I was scheduled. And this is the staff who decided not to show up for an hour, for 2.5 hours, making it so I couldn't make my appointment. Is there any way you could help me get in? Because all the appointments and all the other places are, no, we're not able to do that. Well, then don't bug me about it. If you can't help me. That's the first of my COVID complainings for this podcast. But continue.
Another thing I'm going to bitch at, and I don't normally call out shops, but I'm going to call out the source and Hot Comics. You don't have to jam as many friggin' back issues as you can in your back issue display. I swear, I go to look at their back issues, and they are so tightly packed in there that I either have to bend them in half or just rip half the box out so I can just look inside there. I know space is money. I had a comic shop. Remember this. But you don't – I swear, the guys stacking these books have no clue. We want them in good shape. We don't want people to have to bend them over just to look at it. The old source, I'm talking previous from the old store, used to have these displays where you could flip through the issues on the shelf, but they had a lip that was like halfway up through the book, so the books in front would be bent. You can always tell a book from the old source, or even sometimes the newer one, because it always has that crack in the middle of the spine because people flip it over. I love looking through back issues, but if you've got to make it so you're jamming so many in there, you're doing something wrong with your back issues. You might want to start blowing some of the crap out, i.e. dollar books, and just get rid of them. And generally,
just pull some of them back. You know, you don't need 15 copies of Adventures of Superman number 500.
And
you
even
don't need 20 copies of, you know, each issue of the X-Men. Give them space so that you can look through them. I won't buy. I haven't looked at the back issues at the source since they went into drawers.
Because and the drawers no were brilliant.
Room. Well, and
they,
even
they just
with that,
jam them so tight you can't look at them.
And if you do, you're gonna, you know, anything that's near mint. Nope. Now it's a fine book at best, probably more very good. The Hot Comics, you have way too many back issues.
They're more the traditional comics.
Gonna sell.
Yeah, they're more the traditional comics where they have the tables and everything's laid flat. But again, everything's jammed so tight. Yeah. It's like I have to pull out a fistful of issues just to be able to look at them. When I ran Hack Comics, and to a lesser extent with Crazy Comics, I remember telling – I don't think I told you, but I remember telling some of the other guys, maybe Butch, don't jam them in so tight because I want to be able to flip through them not only to see the title and the issue number on top, but also a little bit of the cover. And, again, if you've got tons of them, and Lord knows by the time I sold Hack Comics – we had, what, 4-5 boxes of The Return of Superman?
Oh, God, yes.
Because it was like in every collection that we bought. And just, you know, again, remember who you're selling to. You're selling the collectors. We're readers, but collectors like their books in good shape. And for the most part, Hot Comics is in the source are good with changing the prices if the condition's different, because I've been trying to fill in holes and I see, well, they got that for $4 and this for 10. Oh, the $10 one's a little bit nicer. But if you jam them too tight, and again, this goes to almost any comic store. I mean, I've looked at stuff at the Comic College as well, and they have some, theirs is mostly in their discount bins where they're jammed really tight. Okay, in your discount bins, that's fine. But yeah, just be merciful to the back issues. I talk constantly on the eBays about back issues because there is interest somewhere, and you're either going to be the source for of people's back issues, or you're just going to give it up to the eBays and people just selling online. So this isn't so much a freaking, but it's just kind of one of those things to go, because I sell a lot on eBay. But I've only had 3 in the last year that disappeared and were never found again, where they get sent out in the mail. And one of them, I suspect the guy got it because he didn't. Usually what I do is if I send something on the eBays and you don't get it in 30 days, I'm just it's never going to be found. I just will usually issue a refund. Sometimes, and again, this isn't on expensive books because them I usually insure. But like if I'm sending you a $4 or $5 comic and you don't have it after 30 days, I'll give you $4 or $5 back. Don't care. I had one guy who just complained and complained and complained. I mean, email after email after email. Oh, you're trying to cheat me. You're trying to do this. I go, yeah. After since after 1998, after over 6,000 unique transactions, you're the guy I'm going rogue on by cheating him out of a $5 comic book. Whatever, dude. Most of the guys are pretty gracious. They accept the money back. And I've had a few actually call back and say, hey, I finally got this thing after the refund. Do you want the money back? And I'm kind of like, you know, not really. I'm not going to bust my buns refiguring out how you're going to send me a $5 payment back. I mean, all I do is I appreciate that you at least let me know you got it. So, again, I don't know if this ties directly into what you talked about, Corey, a couple weeks ago, where, you know, sending stuff media mail might be delaying it or anything. But so far, for the most part, knock on cheap particle board that this desk is made out of, my stuff through the eBays have been pretty good. So that's pretty much it for me, Corey. What are you freaking out? What's got your underwear in a bunch?
First the non-comic one and then the comic one. I have free tickets to go see Godzilla versus King Kong.
Hooray! What did you think of it?
I haven't seen it yet. I was going to go Sunday night because I had, you know, I got done at the group home at 8, and I figured, well, you know, I'll go Sunday evening. And on my way home, I needed to stop at the food mart. So I put on my mask. I go into the grocery store. All the employees have masks on. About half of the people in the grocery store did not. And the people in the grocery store who were not wearing masks gave me the evil eye because I was wearing a mask. Now, I think it's
I usually cough at them.
I have a baby metal mask, and I think they were just mad that they didn't have one.
Oh, I would be mad. I haven't even seen it.
But, you know, here are people, you know, as you said, people still have COVID. Here in Minnesota, we're in a wave of it. And people are like, you know, it's like I'm down in Alabama where he's wearing a mask. He must be one of them gosh darn morons who believes in science. And, you know, just going through the store and everybody without a mask is just glaring at me. And by the time I get to pay, it's like, no, I'm not ready to go out among people. I'm not ready to deal because the general public is still stupid. The general public doesn't understand what's going on. I work with people with compromised immune systems. I have spent a whole year being extra careful because the people I work with, one of our staff went to a underground bar, and I won't say who runs it, but he's a national political figure, even though he's sells crappy bed-related things. They brought COVID into the group home. We have had 5 clients die because of it. We're going to have another one pass away within the next few months because she's on hospice care. Because she got COVID, her respiratory system has never recovered. To me, this is serious. It's real. And the people who treat it like it's, you know, oh, it's just the flu and nobody dies of it. Well, screw you. You're an idiot. And I don't want anything to do with you. So I decided I'm not ready to go to movie theaters yet. I'm not ready to deal with people. I'm not ready to go to public places. And there's a part of me that may never get completely over it. Much like when I watch Japanese wrestling where the fans in attendance wear masks whenever they go to a big indoor gathering, I may do the same thing. The other thing I am freaking on, Joe, you know how it used to be where the third Friday of every month, DC would put out their solicitations. You could count.
Oh, I thought you were talking about. I thought you were going to talk about Friday when like all the tornado sirens went off and people were freaking out because they couldn't understand. Was it? Yeah. It's like. I was very disappointed in my fellow Minnesotans because why are the sirens going off? They're testing. I mean, yeah, if the sirens go off and it's cloudy and it's warm and it's dark, it's probably a tornado, but it was cold, it was funky, and people were like, oh, the sirens are going off, let's go, whatever.
And they announced it on the radio and TV and cable mm-hmm. that's what they were doing. No, it's a Friday, and third Friday of every month, like clockwork, DC's new solicitations come out. Well, the guy who was in charge of those left DC 2 months ago. No one was hired to take his place. And from the rumors around that it's just kind of people in the office are just kind of trying to patch it together. So DC solicitations were late last month. They're late this month. And you complained about how you can't get information on DC's books. This is part of the reason why the guy whose job it was to let us know what books are coming out so that comic shops can order them quit and has not been replaced. What are you geeking on, Joe?
I fell down the YouTube vortex yesterday where I was just having fun. Yeah, do you remember back when Doctor Who had the ultimate question or the final question? Somebody at BBC or somebody put together a wonderful package of all the doctors to that point in kind of a tribute to Doctor Who, going all the way back to William Hartnell and including some of the other ones. And then they did an advanced one where they included some I'm going to blow his last name, Peter Capaldi. Thank you. Then they went back and they did another one where they added stuff on the Master and some of the companions. They just did the person who did those kind of said, I'm not doing it anymore. Somebody picked up the gauntlet and did another version that added Jodie, the current doctor.
Yeah,
I know. So if you haven't, go look for that. It was just a lot of fun.
Jodie Whittaker.
Whittaker, thank you. Didn't we just have this conversation last podcast? I'm having a real deja vu moment here. What's her name? Jodie Foster. No, that wasn't her. I did find something that I remember. Corey, do you remember the Hudson Brothers Razzle Dazzle show?
Yes, I do. In fact.
Oh, my God. Thank you. Somebody else does. I thought I was. This is one of those Lidsville moments where I was like, I tried to describe it to somebody. And the Hudson Brothers were actually a legitimate teen heartthrob rock and roll pop song act. And then they had this little CBS show, lasted maybe a season. And I think they aired it on Sundays here. And it was mostly the same skit, the same acts, very little new content. But God, I loved it. I mean, I could sing the song, Razzle Dazzle, Get Yourself Down. Oh, I found the show intro on the eBays, mostly because Family Guy put it in one of their episodes.
I was going to say, if you're watching Family Guy this season, they showed the entire opening.
Yes.
Which ate up almost 5 minutes of the show.
It is. And one of the reasons why you can't find a lot of it on the eBays is because I think there's one of the original Hudson Brothers still alive. They own the rights and they're very, I don't want to say vindictive, but they're controlling the rights. So much so that I found a 38-minute show dealing with commercials and openings for 70s Saturday morning cartoons, which I just watched because it threw me down montage lane. Like the opening to the Harlem Globetrotters show, Sid and Marty Krofft, Lidsville, Bugaloo, Land of the Lost, Sigma and Sea Monster, H.R. Puff and stuff. Commercials for Honeycomb. Come to the Honeycomb hideout. Honeycomb's big. Yeah. The Evel Knievel stunt cycle, which I guess they've got a remake of it that you can buy somewhere out on the interwebs. It was 38 minutes of fun, but they said they had to cut out the Hudson Brother thing. eBay or YouTube took down the whole video because of the copyright claim. So they cut it out. And then, of course, I went looking for it, found it on the Family Guy, and then found on DailyMotion.com. They also have the whole intro there. Go look at the Family Guy one, though. It's a little more fun. So, I mean, I'm having, like, major flashbacks remembering this. If you want to know a little bit more about my humor, this is something that tied deeply into it. because some, you remember at the end they always had a little kid who was like the executive of the committee, and he would come and he'd talk to the Hudson brothers about how the show went. And he'd go, "Would you guys like any crushed chocolate lollipops?" And they go, "No thanks. Trying to cut down." And as he walked off, he turned back and he'd make this motion with his hand, and the Hudson brothers go, "Mmm." Same thing every single show. It is available on DVD. I mean, I've got Weird Al. I've got Return of the Planet of the Apes. I got DC Follies. I'll probably end up getting this just for, since there are no episodes I can find anywhere that are being streamed or that you don't pay for or that like the YouTube have. So, okay, rant over. What else? Oh, we got Discovery Plus. Not because I wanted it, but because Chris likes it, because there's tons of detective shows and things like that, which she absolutely loves. And they had a good deal on it. What I discovered is my new favorite program, Mysteries of the Abandoned. One of the things I like outside of comics, I got interest outside of comics, abandoned stuff fascinates me. The fact that there are long forgotten engineering marvels, decaying cities, empty factories that once stood and they were cutting edge. You're like, who used these? Who built these? And why were they abandoned? Mysteries of the Abandoned is really cool because they tell you why. And they get into just these different things. Today, these marvels are discarded. They're dangerous. Some of them deadly. Mysteries of the Abandoned reveals why these engineering triumphs were built, how they were left to crumble. Some of them you can guess. You look up and you see, oh, yeah, that was built by the Nazis. But why? And why did they leave it? A lot of it's Cold War driven. Some of it's really back in historical significance and why it's no longer liable. Some of it are things like I can't think of how long it is. It's huge. The Packard automobile plant is just there in Detroit, succumbing to whatever. And you can actually drive down a street and go past this factory, and it's just, oh well, it's amazing. And I'll probably end up watching a few more tonight. Sorry, my wife has a book here. Carpe fucking diem, a journal to seize the fucking day. All right. Let's see. Comic related. I only read one thing because I was waiting. Well, first of all, I read Dark Knight, which we talked about Dark Knight. We should do a show about that. The other thing I picked up in the future. Yeah, maybe in 5 years or so. I reread DC Universe, The Stories of Alan Moore, which is a out-of-print book that has Alan Moore stories from everything he did. The annuals, the Whatever Happened to Superman, his DC Presents, where Swamp Thing and Superman crossed over. Some wonderful Green Lantern stories. His origin of the Phantom Stranger, just a great book, hard to find. I think I found mine for $5 somewhere. So, one thing I am kind of glad I don't collect toys the way I used to, because there are just not a lot of places to buy toys. One of the things I had wanted to buy when it came out was Hasbro is doing Marvel toys, and they had their version of Angela from Guardians of the Galaxy. You can't find it. $30, $40, $50 on eBay. So, you know, there's really only two places to buy toys other than your friendly neighborhood comic store, and that's Target and Walmart. And generally the first person there buys them. I mean, I'm on their various groups. You know, if they find it, they will buy it for you, and you can trade and you can sell and things like that. We're coming up, con season, so hopefully I just missed one. I guess in a mini freaking, there was a comic show last weekend that I guess was really well received. People were just talking about some of the stuff they bought. So it's kind of a minor miracle when I run across a toy or two that I actually go like, hey, I found it. Marvel's got these, I guess they're called Marvel Legends. They're in the classic shape of like the toys you and I remember, Corey, the original Star Wars and the car, not the big $20 ones, but these are still $10. What caught my eye is Carol Danvers, the Avenger Marvel. And not Ms. Marvel, not Captain Marvel, but Carol Danvers. And she's dressed up in her Ms. Marvel lightning bolt outfit with the sash and the, I don't know what you call it, high boots. And
thigh high boots. You could tell that that was by Dave Cockrum. He loved sashes. He loved thigh high boots.
Yeah.
Someone did better costumes in the 70s than Dave Cockrum.
Well, they had, I mean, this is a run. So far, I think it's only at Target. I was able to find Captain America and Carol Danvers. I just thought they were kind of fun. And I guess there's Spider-Man, there's Iron Man, there's a few others. So hopefully they keep it up, but you can never tell. I did find Jar Jar Binks. And you want to know why, Corey?
And why is that?
Well, they were half off.
Oh,
I think it was a Target exclusive because originally they were at $30 and they sat there and they sat there and they sat there. And one day I came in and 50% off, they were all gone. Now they're 70% off. So if you happen to see them hanging, you know, I would advise you to pick it up because this has the makings of a one of those toys that people are going to want. Because first of all, they didn't hang. Target doesn't mess around. When they liquidate toys, they liquidate toys. If you go back to the TVs, they're liquidating a lot of the pulp cultures and some of the other things because they have. There's usually two areas: the regular toys, and then they have all like the media stuff, Stranger Things, Godzilla, whatever. But they're liquidating tons of stuff. I was just happy to buy one. If I had my comic store, I would open it up and we'd be torturing the figure. But the other thing I bought is I found a Mego size POW Entertainment 8-inch action figure, 14-point articulated, based off the old Mego of Stan Lee from POW Entertainment. And he's standing there. He's got his hands in the traditional Spider-Man shooting webs. Yep. Marty Abrams, a.k.a. the father of action figure, relaunched these figures in response to overwhelming demand. And, again, at Target, there's a whole slew of these. I was just happy to find Stan Lee, so I picked that one up. I didn't even know he was there. Again, in a couple more things to geek on, I picked up Jethro Tull's A, the 40th anniversary edition. I was going to pre-order it. Apparently, it's available already. So I went and I found it online in American. It's the 1980s album with its associated tracks, a concert from LA Sports Arena, Slipstream videos. I think there's a couple books in there talking about from Martin Webb talking about recording and touring the album. A is one of my favorite Jethro Tull albums. I didn't get into Jethro Tull until 79. The first one I bought was their live album, and I cannot think of the name of it. The next one was Stormwatch, and then came A. One of the things that I loved about it is, you know, again, I'm a nerdy kid, not a lot of friends. I not only read comic books, but in my mind, I actually for a while wrote down outlines of comic book stories. And then when I started in high school, I put all my high school buds in it as well. And the characters off of Jethro Tull, I drew a lot of inspiration when I would do these fan fiction things. Sadly, not a lot of my stuff survived because I put it in a beer box. If you remember back then, you used to buy beer boxes and they'd have usually like 24 bottles of beer. And then your dad would put the beer back in and bring the box back to the liquor store, and you get credit off that for your next bottle because they recycled the beer bottles and everything. Hard to believe at one time my entire collection fit in two of those type boxes. Anyways, I had my whole storylines in there, and of course, you know, now I'm thinking I should actually flesh those out, but I had a flood, and again, this is like high school years, that basically wiped out that, a lot of my D&D world stuff, again, based mostly on superhero stuff because none of my friends read superhero comics. So, you know, I could take modules and give them characters from the D&D stuff, but they knew that. But I started throwing things like, I am Dr. Doom, or there's this hammer that says, he who lifts it is worthy, can have the power of Thor. Hint, no one could lift it. You got a die roll on it. Nowadays, of course, everybody knows this stuff, but back then, that was my fun. I did actually have, I don't know if you, Corey, if you remember that Sandman statue, that the first statue that came out of Morpheus.
Yeah.
When I was the last, one of the last D&Ds I was playing, and this had been college years, my, you know, blah, 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 party gets in, they find this thing, and okay. And I take the box out. I took the slipcase off the box. I said, open this. I said, be very careful. This thing costs about $500, which was true at the time. And they open it up and they pull Morpheus out. And the look on their faces were like, darr. The idea was eventually they would run into the Sandman, the whole Endless, because none of them were reading Sandman. They had no idea who they were. Never played it out. We graduated, blah, 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 whatever. End of D&D as we know it. So, again, I had fun with some of that stuff. And that's why I bought Jethro Tull 8. Finally, my new crack. And I know they've been out before, but I don't eat a lot of candies being diabetic. But someone at work had a bowl of M&M caramel chocolate candies.
Oh, yes.
I've only got 3 left in my pack. I've been chewing on them the entire time we've been talking. And Corey, tell you what, I think I'm done. I'm gonna chew on a couple of these. What are you geeking on now, Corey?
One of my favorite series in an odd way that Marvel did in the 90s was Marvel Comics Superheroes, which basically was all the stuff that had been made for fill-ins that had gone out of date and wasn't good enough to be a Marvel fanfare. Got put in this comic. It was an 80-page comic, came out quarterly. The only reason anybody now knows it is because it was the first appearance of Squirrel Girl. But it had the final 2 issues of Ms. Marvel in it, where Ms. Marvel fought, first she fought Sabretooth, and then issue 23, then issue 24 was the one which would have been the first appearance of Rogue, and it ends with Rogue taking her powers and her memory and dropping her in the ocean, which is where Avengers Annual 10 picks up. And when I read through it again recently, it's very clear that Claremont had a different ending, and they drew an extra 2 or 3 pages because the art looks very different, very rushed, very bad for that sequence. But it's got all sorts of wonderful little gems in it, like a Vision Scarlet Witch story drawn by Mike Mignola, a Moon Knight story written by Robert Ingersoll, who was a public defender in Cleveland, who wrote a column in Comic Buyer's Guide about legal mistakes made in comics. Just all of these weird little stories that they had done so that they would have a fill-in in case somebody missed a deadline and either the book didn't exist anymore or it was horribly out of date, or in some cases stuff that was made for Marvel Comics Presents that they bought and decided not to put in there. I've been picking them up at when we go on our crap runs, you know, going to comic shops and digging through the quarter of dollar bins. And I've got all of them except the Squirrel Girl one, which is in the storage locker with all my other, you know, with the comics basically from before 2005 are all in there. Because that's when my son needed the bedroom. So I put that run together and I've been reading that, and it's just fun, goofy, weird crap. None of the stories are great. It's just more interesting to me because you get people at the beginning of their career or at the end of their career, or people who were trying out for Marvel. And a lot of these read like, okay, we're going to give this guy a chance, and then no other books from them or no other art from them. Or, you know, some of them are, you know, old time artist with a brand new inker, or brand new artist with a veteran inker. So it's really interesting to see the kind of stuff that they would have sitting in the drawer in case somebody missed a deadline, which they don't do anymore. And in a way, I kind of miss that. I miss those fill-ins rather than a book being late. But now that books are very much driven by, this is the guy who's writing it, and he's got this story arc he's doing. It's not like the old days when it was a soap opera and you could drop in a fill-in story. The other thing, Box Day showed up. I hold in my hand one of the greatest books ever. It is called Brain Bats of Venus, The Life and Comics of Basil Wolverton, Volume 2. I have Volume 1. This isn't just reprinting the Basil Wolverton stories that they can reprint. It is also a biography of him that goes into huge detail. It has his non-comics work, such as art he did for advertising and tryouts he did for comic strips and stuff he did for churches, as well as a lot of his horror stuff from the late 40s, early 50s. Some of the humor stuff, but a lot of the stories from the comic Weird Tales of the Future. Now, Weird Tales of the Future, the entire series has gone public domain. And there are a number of public domain sites where you could download it. I strongly recommend download Weird Tales of the Future. Most of the stories are mediocre and, you know, amateurish and tedious. But the Basil Wolverton stuff is beautiful and weird. And I love anything that's both beautiful and weird. And then the last thing I am geeking on, Butch and I have been sending emails back and forth. Somehow he remembered how to email. The other big book I got in my box day was the first volume of the Defenders Omnibus. Now, I'm not happy with how big the book is. It's only around 700 pages for $100. And you're saying, 700 pages? Oh, that's a lot of comics. But when it comes to omnibuses, it's not huge. But as I started reading, you know, you get all of the buildup, which went through, you know, basically Doctor Strange's book was canceled, and Roy Thomas used Hulk and Submariner to wrap up the plot threads, and then started a new series called The Defenders in a comic called Marvel Features. Kind of a tryout. And it worked, so they started a Defenders series, and you know, Roy Thomas didn't write it. He gave it immediately to new writer, Steve Englehart. Sal Buscema took over with the second issue. I want to check, because I know Ross Andrew drew the first issue. Let's see. Yeah, second issue, Sal Buscema. So you have Sal Buscema drawing it. And so it's Steve Englehart and Sal Buscema, probably the most 70s book ever written. And the early issues are Submariner, Hulk, and Doctor Strange, and they don't much like each other, but they still end up working together a lot. And it was later on that they brought in Nightwing and Valkyrie and other characters. But there's this fun, weird dynamic, and I never understood as a kid why the Defenders were the non-team. They're not a real team. But in these issues, it's clear that they don't like each other, but they have to put up with each other because of circumstances. And it's just a very 70s book that I enjoy. As for modern stuff, I really wish I could say I've been reading some modern stuff, but I just have not had time. I was stuck at the group home all weekend and was not able to read a bunch of new comics. I had to read stuff that was either on my tablet or one of the books in the car, because the guy with Box Day showed up on Thursday as I was leaving for work. I had already locked the house, so I just said, "Yeah, fine, I'll just throw it in the back seat of the car." So then when I was at work and everybody was asleep by 7:30 and I had to be there till 10, it's like, screw it, I'm going to open my box and read some stuff. So believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about comics for an hour and a half.
Before we get too far, a couple things first. If you are an omnibus, and if you know, occasionally we recommend things in our preview episodes that go for outrageous money today, I recommend you buy the Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle Omnibus because, well, not because this story was okay, but it's a licensed omnibus. Ain't no way in hell that's ever going to be reprinted. Second off, do we want to share the email we got from Butch?
Well, first I want to say, Joe, remember when I asked you for $1 million and you said no? You could have saved a whole lot of money because that Action Comics number one Ashcan, it sold for $204,000. Well, it was very affordable. You could have loaned me that money and we could have got it. It did depress me that in that same auction, they're auctioning off a first printing of the Tales from the Crypt box set, like the one I have, although I don't think mine is a first printing, for around $500.
Wow.
Am I ever selling mine? Hells no. So, what you can share Butch's email if you
okay,
like.
Yeah, as you
we
know,
didn't
Butch,
know you were even reading them.
We didn't even know he was listening. Well, we know he listens, but you know, and Butch, of course, as soon as you're ready, buddy, we're ready to get you on the show. And of course, Corey brought up a point. I don't know. Did you say? I'm just going to read it. It says Corey writes, for this week's show, I was reading Dark Knight again. And now that I know more about art, it's amazing how much Klaus Janson brought to the art. And he's still inking, which is cool. But Butch writes, the preparation and consumption of which was soundtracked by your second episode about Crazy Convention Sketchbook, which is what he puts it, which is delightful. You two are geniuses, and I'm jealous, and I want to be a genius too. I think it was only Corey who I recently told that I was listening to the first episode about Cray and his magical convention sketchbook and found myself responding to you guys as if I was there. Mental instability aside, I greatly enjoyed the broadcast, and the second one was even more over. I had bits to add and quite a lot to the stories and who, what, where, when, how, zers. Then you dumb guy apes left me hanging only halfway through the book. Can't wait till the next one, which, by the way, is recorded. It's ready for a fill-in episode.
That was last week. Remember,
was it?
You were up north.
Oh, that's right. Well, then we'll have to finish recording the next one. Butch writes, I can't wait till the next one. So we got that going. And then, of course, Butch has his own sketchbook. And, of course, Butch ends it with, anyways, I got to run because after I find my sketchbook, Griffith, or as we call him, Little Mike, and I are going to start a Criterion series where we do commentary on every episode of Crazy Comics and Stories, which makes me remember, here's a little-known factoid of no useful information. I have a Butch's convention sketchbook story from John's 1984 St. Paul Comic Convention, which launched Abada and Crazy Comic Sellers, P&J Comics back then, and, of course, Joe's convention sketchbook. And that story involves the mysterious Mike Griffith. Who is this Mike Griffith? Boy, I wish I could talk to Little Mike instead. You know what, Corey?
What?
I think it's time to hit my music.
Done, bitches!